Today is Friday, September 18th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. How has Singapore managed to have so few COVID-19 deaths?
First, Singapore was very successful in containing the spread of the virus through early detection, using aggressive contact tracing and testing that won praise from the WHO.
Plus the role social media plays in addressing human rights violations.
Social media companies told Human Rights Watch they are required by law to remove material that could be offensive or incite terror, violence or hatred.
We'll have these stories and more next. Heading into the weekend, there are roughly 30 million COVID-19 cases around the world. And Britain is struggling with its COVID-19 testing capacity as demand appears to outpace supply. There are also other problems elsewhere in Europe. Reuters' Joe Davies has the story.
The days are getting shorter in Europe, but in some countries the wait to get a coronavirus test is getting longer. It's raising concerns with spikes in cases and fears of a big second wave of the virus in the winter. The United Kingdom is having among the most acute problems. This week, the UK government promised to do whatever it takes to boost laboratory capacity, which has left thousands struggling to get a test. Prime Minister Boris Johnson promised in May to create a world-beating system to test and trace people exposed to the virus. But Reuters has seen hundreds lining up waiting hours for tests, such as here in the town of Southend-on-Sea. Some said they'd been trying to get tested for 4 days. The government says fixing the system would take weeks, and it's not alone. Other major European countries have also had hiccups. Germany introduced free tests for returning travellers this summer on concerns over rising infection numbers. But it backtracked only a few weeks later as labs faced capacity constraints. And the data blunder in Bavaria meant around 1,000 people with positive results were not told. France, another one of those badly hit right now, is conducting around 1 million tests a week, according to its government. But it's struggling to keep up with demand. Long lines have been snaking outside testing centres in Paris. Very few appointments are available for tests for several weeks in advance.
Turning to Asia, what lessons can be learned from Singapore's low fatality rate? Reuters reporter Emer McCarthy takes things from here.
Singapore, the city-state of 5.7 million people, has seemingly weathered the COVID-19 storm better than anywhere else in the world, with a death rate of only 0.05%, way lower than the global average of about 3%, even among countries of similar size like Denmark and Finland. It means that of the 57,000 infections, there's only been 27 deaths in Singapore. But how has the island managed such a feat? Singapore's leading disease experts said there's a number of factors behind the country's success. First, Singapore was very successful in containing the spread of the virus through early detection, using aggressive contact tracing and testing that won praise from the WHO. It has tested nearly 900,000 people, one of the highest per capita rates globally. Dormitory residents have been put on a rostered testing regime. Authorities have undertaken mass testing among vulnerable communities, including care homes, and anyone over 13 with signs of acute respiratory infection is offered a free test. This preemptive approach has also been applied to treatment. Doctors said that COVID-19 patients above 45 years or with underlying conditions are cared for in hospital, even if they are otherwise well. It also built up bed space for coronavirus patients in exhibition halls and temporary facilities to house those with mild or no symptoms. This prevented the healthcare system from being overwhelmed so that attention and resources could be focused on the more severe cases. It's difficult to compare across borders, though. Singapore strictly adheres to the WHO's case definition for classifying COVID-19 deaths, so it does not include non-pneumonia fatalities like those caused by blood or heart issues among COVID-19 patients in its official tally. The country's health ministry has said its approach is consistent with international practice.
Joe Davies and Emer McCarthy both report for Reuters News. Alexei Navalny's team said on Thursday that the nerve agent used to poison him was detected on an empty water bottle from his hotel room in the Siberian city of Tomsk, suggesting that he was poisoned there and not at the airport as previously thought. Now, to get an update on that story as well as the latest in Belarus, I spoke with reporter Charles Maines in Moscow via WhatsApp.
Right. So what they're saying is that, you know, from the very beginning, when this poisoning occurred, or alleged poisoning, if you want to take the Russian government's point of view, back on August 20th, you know, this consensus was that basically Navalny had had some tea at the airport before getting on a plane. He was in Siberia, got on a plane to Moscow and fell violently ill. And if you fast forward, now he's, of course, in Germany being treated. But what was interesting about today's announcement from Navalny's team was that, in fact, they say that they, in the hours after his poisoning, after he'd fallen ill on this plane, they went to the hotel where he was staying at in the Siberian city of Tomsk, and they collected evidence. They wore gloves, they bagged evidence, including water bottles, and they found a way, apparently, to get them to the German investigators, who have concluded that it was from these water bottles that that some of this Novichok, the Soviet-era nerve agent, was put in, was basically given to Mr. Navalny. There are a lot of questions about how this happened, frankly, about how it was delivered to Berlin. There are some theories there. Also, frankly, about how other people weren't infected by this Novichok agent while they were collecting it. So at this point, we don't have a lot of information, frankly, but this seems to be the version that Mr. Navalny himself endorsed when he published a video of his colleagues in his hotel room today, which seemed to show them sort of collecting evidence and trying to be careful. Again, they were wearing gloves, but we're talking about a very, very deadly nerve agent.
Has the Russian government put forward any formal statements in the wake of this?
You know, the Russian position is pretty straightforward. I mean, they're saying that from the very beginning that the doctors who treated Mr. Navalny in the immediate aftermath of his sickness, of his illness, found no traces of poison or anything similar to it. So, you know, the suggestions here, whether depending on kind of their levels of conspiracy, but you know, the sort of the extreme one is that somehow Mr. Navalny, let's put it this way, different levels of conspiracy, but the basic version comes down to the fact that if from the Russian government's point of view, Mr. Navalny had no evidence of being poisoned before he left for Berlin for treatment. And then the German authorities and then subsequently French and Swedish laboratories also confirmed this as well, found traces of this nerve agent, this Novichok.
Navalny's team put out a statement over the weekend saying that it is his intent to return to Russia after he is discharged from the Berlin hospital. Has there been any additional information stating his rationale and reasoning for saying that he wants to do that?
Well, they say that there was never, first of all, I think it's important to point out that I don't think it was quite clear until Mr. Navalny appeared back on social media this week with a post that had a sort of trademark kind of sense of humor that he was okay. I think people understood that he was out of danger in terms of losing his life. But the fact that he'd been in an artificial coma for 3 weeks, you don't know the effects of that. So I think, first of all, there's a lot of relief from his supporters there. But in terms of his press secretary put out answered comments, these were questions put to her by journalists, saying that always the plan was for him to return to Russia. I think that's a little bit hard to believe, given that I don't think they knew quite what condition he was in until very, very recently. But in terms of what the effects of that might be, that's a different question. I think, you know, Navalny has been, you know, he's managed to put together a national movement on a very small scale, but still in a country where he's been denied access to elections, he's not covered in the state media, or if he is covered, he's covered in a very negative light. If nothing else, it certainly adds to this sense of a legend, you know, that somehow he's this kind of underground force here that could influence things. But we'll just have to see.
Now, Charles, I want to switch topics, but still stay in the region and focus on Belarus. And specifically, I want to ask you for updates on Vitaly Skrilarov. He's an individual with dual citizenship, Belarus and American, and the wife of a U.S. consular official who's been in custody for well over a month. And his wife, Heather, says that he's in immediate danger. So what can you tell us about the reporting that's coming out on that?
Yeah, so with Vitaly Skrilarov, he as his wife has made this statement to the media, somewhat unusually, she's a consular officer in Kiev, and it's unusual, frankly, for a U.S. State Department employee who's not at the top of the ranks to make these kind of statements. But, you know, the concern came from the fact that not only has Mr. Shlarev been held in a Belarusian prison now for 6 weeks, he's been named a political prisoner by some of the leading human rights groups within Belarus, but frankly, he's also been, there are real concerns about his health. Heather Shlarev, his wife, mentioned that he has been complaining about symptoms very similar to what would appear to be COVID-19. And in fact, I spoke with his lawyer yesterday, who says that in the aftermath of this announcement of this media release by Heather Shlarev, he was given access to a doctor for the first time. They did take a COVID-19 test. They don't have the results yet. And in Belarus, they take three before they draw any conclusions. More alarmingly, perhaps, the lawyer also said that Mr. Shlarev has complained about a loss of sense of smell and taste, which are symptoms associated with the COVID-19 infection. And so we'll just have to see what happens going forward. But in terms of his general status, there's no question that the Belarusian authorities seem to be pressing forward with these charges. They've linked him to this kind of grander scheme that's being put forth by President Alexander Lukashenko, that it's Western powers driving this protest movement, this democratic uprising we're seeing that's involved hundreds of thousands of people now on the streets. His best bet in terms of defending his regime seems to be suggesting to Russia, to Russian President Vladimir Putin in particular, that this is a Western plot to expand NATO to Russia's borders. So Mr. Shlarev, given his past as a political analyst, as a campaign manager in presidential campaigns, both in the U.S. and Russia and Georgia, in the neighboring Soviet Republic of Georgia, he seems to fit this kind of category that seems very helpful to the Belarusian president as he makes that case.
I understand there's also reports that President Lukashenko may be looking at closing some borders.
Well, so what we're seeing right now is this, again, Mr. Lukashenko this is the most serious, challenge to his 26-year rule that he's ever faced. And he's taking desperate measures. We've seen him now announce today that he's closing the border with neighboring states. That's Lithuania, that's Poland, that's Ukraine. And this plays again into this narrative that he's been pushing, that NATO forces are gathering at the border ready to attack. There's no evidence of that. NATO command has said that this is simply not true. In terms of the European response, we've seen, some talk of sanctions against Belarus going forward. And certainly some of these European countries, there is a bit of split in terms of what reaction to take to this police crackdown we've seen, these mass arrests in Belarus. Closer states, neighboring states like Lithuania, frankly, don't recognize the results of the vote. Other countries may also not be willing to recognize, but they don't really know what to do, in the sense that I think there's a sense among some Western allies that if they go in too heavy on Belarus, that may invite some kind of Russian intervention.
Charles Maines reports from Moscow, Russia. And coming up later,
whales are really important as top predators in the ocean, so they actually help to maintain healthy food webs. They support coastal economies through tourism, and then they're actually also important for the climate in terms of the amount of carbon that they pull into the ocean.
This is VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
According to legend, the Fountain of Youth is supposed to be a magical spring that brings back youth and vitality to those who drink or bathe in its waters. Medical science continues its quest for some kind of miraculous elixir that could stop and reverse the aging process in people. A recent study by researchers at the University of California, Berkeley, suggests science just might be close to providing a medical version of the Fountain of Youth. The researchers working with mice replaced half of the blood plasma in old mice with a mixture of saline and albumin, the chief protein in blood. They found that this treatment rejuvenated tissues and reversed signs of aging in the old mice. The Berkeley team says it's now completing clinical trials to find out if a modified version of this therapy might in the future be able to improve the health of old people. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Social media companies are taking down videos and images that could be vital in prosecuting serious crimes, according to a new report from Human Rights Watch. Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter are increasingly using artificial intelligence algorithms to remove material deemed offensive or illegal. Human Rights Watch says vital evidence is being missed or destroyed. Henry Ridgewell has more.
The Russian missile launcher that prosecutors say was used to fire the weapon that brought down Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 in 2014. The videos were collated from social media sites by the organization Bellingcat, whose evidence was used by the multinational joint investigation team leading the criminal investigation. Russia denies involvement.
What we know from Bellingcat is at some point in the later stages of the investigation, they went back to look at the sources, some of the social media posts that they'd used to substantiate their investigations in order to provide that to judicial authorities in the Netherlands. And at that point, the content had come down.
Evidence from social media plays a central role in many investigations, like these videos uncovered by Amnesty International, purportedly showing abuses carried out by the Nigerian army during its offensive against the terror group Boko Haram. In its new report, titled Video Unavailable, Human Rights Watch warns vital evidence is being deleted.
What we started to notice in the last few years, particularly since 2017, is that we would see a video of, let's say, soldiers executing someone or, you know, an ISIS propaganda video. And, you know, if 15 minutes later, an hour later, we went back to look at the video again, it was suddenly gone.
Social media companies told Human Rights Watch they are required by law to remove material that could be offensive or incite terror, violence, or hatred. As well as human moderators, many also use artificial intelligence algorithms to take down material.
Nowadays, these algorithms are so effective that they are taking down content the minute it gets posted. So no user ever actually gets to see that content before it comes down.
That includes law enforcement agencies pursuing criminal convictions. The International Criminal Court issued its first arrest warrant in 2017 based largely on evidence collected from social media for the Libyan commander Mahmoud al-Werfali, accused of murdering several captives. Civil society groups like Syria Archive are using social media videos to document potential war crimes, including the use of chemical weapons.
What we're calling for is the creation of some kind of global mechanism, sort of an archive or library.
Human Rights Watch says it is in dialogue with social media companies about creating such an archive. Twitter said it is unable to provide civil society organizations access to users' content without an appropriate legal warrant. Facebook and YouTube had not responded to Human Rights Watch or VOA requests for comment by the time of publication. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
A UN watchdog group reports gross violations of human rights, many which could amount to crimes against humanity, continue unabated in Burundi, despite a change in leadership. The Commission of Inquiry on Burundi, which was appointed 4 years ago, will submit its just-launched final report to the UN Human Rights Council next week. Lisa Schlein has those details.
During the past 4 years, the three-member panel has been the only independent international mechanism to document, monitor, and report on human rights violations in Burundi. The panel is concerned that this oversight will disappear when it ends its mandate. It is urging continued international scrutiny of Burundi's human rights record. Hopes were raised conditions in the country might change for the better under the newly installed government of Evariste Ndayishimiye, who was elected president following the death of former president Pierre Nkurunziza. However, president of the commission, Dudu Diene, tells VOA, people appointed to key positions in the government have been identified by the commission, international NGOs, and the European Union as having been responsible for human rights violations.
It means that those who have been committing the violation are still in position of power. The majority of the new authorities are from the military section of the country. So which means that the military has the preeminent position, and this is not certainly the best criteria for a democratic country.
The report notes relatively little political violence occurred in the lead-up to the country's general election in May. Commission member Françoise Hampson attributes this largely to international scrutiny of the event. But she says this period of calm has ended.
In recent weeks, there have continued to be killings. There have continued to be arbitrary detention, and there have continued to be disappearances. So it's slightly surprisingly, perhaps, it's continuing as it was, even though the elections are finished. And that is a matter of very grave concern.
Hampson calls this a missed opportunity. Because there has been a change of political leadership, she says it would have been easier for the new government to change direction for the better without losing face. The Commission's final report is based on more than 1,500 testimonies collected since the start of its work, including more than 300 during the current term of office. The report has been sent to the government, who, as of Thursday, had not responded. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
A new revelation from the U.S. Justice Department underscores the Trump administration's efforts to highlight and crack down on protest-related violence across the nation. AP Washington correspondent Sagar Magani reports.
A spokeswoman says the department looked into whether it could pursue either criminal or civil charges against city officials in Portland, Oregon, as clashes erupted nightly over the summer, researching whether the officials' rhetoric and actions may have helped spur the violence. Federal officials had been told Portland police were explicitly ordered not to help federal officers sent to help deal with the unrest. The department did not say whether charges will be brought. Sagar Magani, Washington.
A Rwandan court has denied bail to Paul Rusesabagina, whose story inspired the film Hotel Rwanda, saying the terrorism charges against him are serious and that he should remain in detention for another month. Rusesabagina, a Belgian citizen and U.S. permanent resident who has criticized President Paul Kagame, faces charges that could bring up to 25 years in prison. His family and supporters assert that he was taken to Rwanda against his will. He has told the New York Times he boarded a private plane in Dubai, thinking he was going to Burundi, but instead stepped out and was surrounded by Rwandan soldiers. Hundreds of migrants on Greece's island of Lesbos finally have a new place to stay, and AP correspondent Karen Chamas has the details.
Wearing masks and white coveralls, police escorted migrants camped out on a roadside to the new site on the island. The notoriously squalid Maria camp burned down last week, leaving more than 12,000 people in need of emergency shelter. Astrid Castellin, head of the UN Refugees Agency office on Lesbos, said it was essential that the migrants were found a new home.
It is a risk for security, for public health, and it's not dignity which we need for everyone.
Most of the migrants made homeless set up makeshift shelters made of sheets, blankets, reeds and cardboard along a stretch of road near the gutted camp. Authorities said the fires had been set deliberately by a small group of inhabitants angered by COVID-19 lockdown restrictions. I'm Karen Chamas.
Even judging by size alone, whales are one of the most impressive mammals on the planet. The blue whale, for example, is the largest animal that has ever lived. Sadly, most whale species were hunted to near extinction by the whale industry, which hunted them for their blubber, their meat, and other body parts. While many species have been making a slow comeback, untold number of whales are still needlessly killed from collisions with huge commercial vessels, such as cargo ships or oil tankers. However, a new technology innovation called WhaleSafe, which is the result of over 3 years of international scientific collaboration, is focused on addressing that issue, apparently with no downside to whales or the shipping industry. Now, to find out more, VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with WhaleSafe lead scientist Morgan Vasali, a marine conservation scientist with the Benoif Ocean Initiative at the University of California at Santa Barbara. She explained why whales are important beyond their unmatched ability to impress.
Whales are really important as top predators in the ocean. So they actually help to maintain healthy food webs. They support coastal economies through tourism. And then they're actually also important for the climate in terms of the amount of carbon that they pull into the oceans.
I know that generally these magnificent creatures are endangered from overfishing, pollution, even commercial whaling, a whole host of reasons.
And one of them is actually when large ships can hit and kill whales in these parts of the ocean where there's a lot of shipping traffic that overlaps with important whale habitat. When whales and ships meet, that usually doesn't mean good things for the whale. And of course, nobody wants to hit and kill a whale, just that the ships are so large and really difficult to be able to see the spout of a whale from the top of these ships.
So tell me about WhaleSafe.
It's a technology-based mapping and data tool that collects real-time data on whales in these hotspots where we see a lot of ship traffic. And it seeks to get that information out to the government and out to the shipping industry so that they know when whales are in the area, and then they can slow down. Studies have shown that if ships can reduce their speed, that really reduces the risk of these fatal collisions happening. And it can also reduce the risk that if a collision does occur, that it will be fatal.
Can you give me an example of a place where slowing down has actually had a measurable impact?
On the east coast of the United States, there's the North Atlantic right whale, which is critically endangered. There's only about 400 animals remaining in that population. And one study had shown that when slow speed zones were put in place in critical parts of their habitat, it actually reduced fatal ship strikes by 80 to 90%.
Has WhaleSafe itself been introduced anywhere yet?
Yeah, so the first WhaleSafe system has been deployed off the coast of California near the ports of Los Angeles and Long Beach, which is one of the busiest port complexes in the world. And in this region is also a really important habitat for endangered blue, humpback, and fin whales that come to this region to feed. And we have deployed different types of sensors. One of the sensors is an acoustic monitoring system. It's basically like a microphone that's under the water that is listening for the calls of whales when they're vocalizing to each other. And there's actually a small computer connected to the microphone that listens to the sounds and is able to identify when we hear a blue, a humpback, or a fin whale calling. There's then a satellite transmitter that sends those detections back to a scientist on shore who's able to confirm them before they are added to a database. That's one of the technologies that we use. We also have a model that is basically like weather forecasting, but for blue whales. In the same way that your weather app can let you know if it's about to rain by using different types of environmental data, this map can let you know if there are likely to be blue whales based on oceanographic data like sea surface temperature, for example.
I know that actually moving shipping lanes for some of these huge ships is also a strategy.
There have been cases around the world where we have actually moved shipping lanes. So that is definitely an option. But it just depends on the location that you're working in and whether it's a constrained waterway, whether there are options for other places that the shipping lanes or shipping traffic can go. But in other places in the world, rerouting or moving the shipping lanes could be possible options as well.
Any incidents of whale ship collisions off the African coast?
I know there is risk of ship strikes off of South Africa. There have been southern right whales. Also in the Strait of Gibraltar, there have been fin and sperm whales. And then also off the Canary Islands, I know that sperm whales, there have been some issues with ship strikes there. So it is something that occurs all over the world. And we're hoping that the WhaleSafe technology can be replicated in other places so that we can find ways for ships and whales to coexist.
That was Morgan Vasali, a marine scientist with the Banoif Ocean Initiative at the University of California at Santa Barbara. Specializing in marine conservation and policy, she was speaking with VOA's Adam Phillips in New York. And you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com on your phone, on your tablet, or any other electronic device. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, have a great Friday, and an amazing weekend.